Boker Tov to everybody. Now that we have our source sheets, we're all prepared. I hope everybody is well. This is the second part of a two-part little module. Next week we'll go on to other pastors new. But this is the second part of a series on the issue of Torah and secular studies. Just by way of, before we get into the shiur, a couple of people are asking me, I'm actually speaking after this in Beth Knesset and Asi, and for those who are asking, I'm not speaking about the same subject. So I'm speaking on a different subject. There is a three-part series starting today there. But we are today talking about Torah Umada. Torah Umada is much talked about, but perhaps less understood. Make sure that everyone has these.
Do you have a sheet?
The subject last week, what would you like? There's a sheet here. Who needs a sheet?
Bakasha. They made enough for everybody.
It's a shame if people didn't get them. There are some on the chair over there if people need, so no one should be without. Last week we talked about Torah in Derech Eretz, and we looked a little bit at Rav Hirsch. This week I want to apologize in advance. Maybe it's not an apology that's needed, but most of the sources on today's sheet are in English. That's not because I translated them, it's because they were written in English. And to translate them into Hebrew seems to me to be a wasted exercise. There are a few in Hebrew, but there are mostly in English. And quite a lot of today's shiur will be dedicated to the words of Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, who wrote one of the key works on this particular issue called Torah Umada. But we won't exclusively be looking at his approach. There are many approaches to this question. And I think it's very important because Yeshiva University, Stern College, and all of the programs that spin off from them are one of the most important Jewish institutions of the last 80, 90 years, certainly in North America and probably all around the world. It has an enormous impact on, I'm sure, many of the people sitting in this room in terms of family and friends and background. But it also is a flagship, if you like, of the concept of Torah Umada. So we need to try and understand a little bit what that stands for. And we'll see, it's not a monochrome view. There are multifaceted approaches. Let's start with a source from Eicha Rabba, which is well known, which I don't think anyone disagrees on, which is Im Yom Elchad and Yesh Chochma Vagoyim Tamim. If anybody tells you that there is wisdom in the non-Jewish world, you better believe it. They got a lot of stuff. Ta'amin, Havahudik Siv, Va'avadati Chachamim Me'edom. God says there, the prophet of Avia says, I will destroy the wise people from Edom, Utzfuna Mehara Esav, and the Tzfuna, and the understanding, the Bina from Har Esav, the world of Edom, the non-Jewish world out there, Western civilization, which is often associated with Edom, is a world of Chachma. Yesh Torah Begoyim. But if people say to you that there is Torah amongst the non-Jewish world, Al Ta'amin. Don't believe them. What they have is not Torah. Dechsev Malke v'sareha bagoyim ein Torah. They have kings, they have princes, they have governments, they have chokhmah, but they do not have Torah. And that's a very important distinction. And the relationship between chokhmah and Torah is one which we need to investigate a little bit today. I brought you as a starting point a little piece by Rabbi Saul Berman. He wanted to try and set out different attitudes to Torah Umada. And these were his four, but I think you could split them even more into other subcategories. Let's just have a brief look at what he says here. The first one is what we would call, I think, Torah Umada or Torah in Derech Eretz. They're not the same thing, but they both kind of fit into attitude one. That the Torah is entirely true, they all start with that. Human reason applied to the study of all reality can also produce truth. Meaning, is there an emet outside Torah? And this view will say, yes, there is. There is an emet to chokhmah, like we just saw, chokhmah by goyim tamim. We are required to engage with and study both Torah and other knowledge in order to properly achieve love and fear of God. Meaning we cannot get to true avos Hashem Yerushalayim without going outside the world of Torah. This is this view. We are permitted to study any aspect of human culture which enriches our intellectual, spiritual, or aesthetic identities. However, where the application of these studies might lead to behavior in conflict with Torah, we must submit to Torah. This is him trying to set out the views. He's saying that basically where things conflict in halakha, in all of these areas there are potential conflicts with halakha. In the world of art, it can overstep the line into idolatry. okay, or inappropriate art. We have to be careful about that, and we must submit to Torah. Engagement in this struggle is positive and results in a responsible, learning, thinking, and spiritually vibrant community. That is the position, definitely, of Torah Amada. Torah and Derech Eretz fits somewhere into that as well. We'll look at the difference between them soon. A slightly less positive attitude towards the Mada is in number two, attitude two. The Torah is entirely true. Science contains partial truths, which are capable of yielding technological advances beneficial to humanity. Jews may study such knowledge only as necessary in order to benefit to contribute to the increase of beneficial technology, or in order to earn a dignified living for the support of the family. Meaning, what is the purpose of secular study? Parnassa. And we can build the world, and we need to build bridges, and we need to make the world work, but it's really for parnassa. It's not for personal edification. That's the second attitude. The third attitude, the Torah is entirely true. Other sources of knowledge, while contaminated by falsity, may produce information which could enhance the study of Torah and the performance of mitzvahs, and may to that extent permissibly be studied. Such study ought to be delayed until after wholeness in Torah study has been achieved. Meaning, according to the third view, what is the purpose of Chochmah? Well, if you don't know how to add up, you won't be able to learn Gemara, because every now and then you need to do a bit of math. If you don't know geography, then you don't know where Kaputkia is. And when the Gemara talks about Kaputkia, you'll think it's somewhere in the middle of Africa, where it's actually somewhere in Turkey. You have to know a little bit of Chochmah to understand your Limudei Kodesh, and therefore there's a value to that degree. And the fourth attitude is, all truth is contained exclusively in the Torah. Other sources of knowledge are contingent, contaminated by falsity. The duty of the Jew is to be engaged exclusively in the study of Torah. That's obviously not a Torah or Mada approach in terms of the Mada, but I think these four attitudes are helpful because they pretty much span the range of the people that walk the streets in the Jewish communities in terms of their attitude towards Torah. But I'm really focusing now on attitude number one, trying to understand that. Where is that coming from? Where are its sources? Meaning, what right does Yeshiva University have to champion the cause of Torah Amada when the majority of the Orthodox world thinks it's illegitimate? And that's a good question. How can they? And they'll say, okay, well, so Rav Soloveitchik said it's legitimate. Good. So where did he get it from? Where is it coming from? I think we need to ask that question. And therefore, I've brought you a lot of quotes from Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb's book. Norman Lamb, obviously, Rabbi Lamb was the Dean of Yeshiva University for many, many years, through the 60s, 70s, 80s, into the 90s, and is still a very important figure in New York. You can meet him, you'll see him in the Jewish Center and other places in the Upper West Side, a really critical figure. And he wrote a book called Torah Amada, which has been reprinted recently, which I thoroughly recommend from beginning to end as an interesting study on this topic. I have taken out about 15 different choice quotes from the book. I hope I haven't misrepresented him in any way. Certainly none of the words are mine, they're his words, and hopefully they're not decontextualized. Let's have a look at what he says. Number three. The ideal on which the institution, Yeshiva University, was based, and which it exemplified, is, and here's the key word, the synthesis. It's the S word. The synthesis of Torah learning and Western culture that goes by the name of Torah Amada. Meaning, whereas Torah in Derech Eretz is not a synthesis, Rav Hirsch is not trying to combine anything. He's building Torah upon a foundation of Derech Eretz. Torah and Mada is trying to combine something. They're trying to merge somehow Torah and Mada into a synthesis of Torah learning of Western culture, or the study of sacred Jewish texts along with the secular wisdom, Chochmah Vagoyim, of the world at large. And therefore, the key question is to try and understand what he means by synthesis. So let's have a look and a few quotes also from Rabbi Lamb here. And we'll see Rabbi Belkin at the end. So he quotes Tertullian. Tertullian is an early Christian thinker. Famous man. What has Athens to do with Jerusalem? He says, two completely different things, the church and the state. Render unto Caesar. What is Caesar's? Etc., etc. The two are not connected. What agreement is there between the academy and the church, says Tertullian? Now, says Rabbi Lamb, for this Latin church father, the gulf between them was unbridgeable. This assertion is at one piece with his famous statement, credo quia absurdum est. Now, this is not all Christian thinking, but one element in Christian thinking is credo. I believe it. Why? Because it makes no sense. Quia absurdum est. And there's a certain logic to that, meaning the more sense it makes, the more likely this to be produced by people who produce the kind of things I understand. And the less sense it makes, the more likely it is to come from God, because that's why I don't understand it. Says Rabbi Lam, such anti-rationalism has never found a warm and hospitable reception amongst classic Jewish thinkers. And that's true. We, on the contrary, the more it makes sense, the more we believe it. Svara is an incredibly important, a greatly important source of law. In the Gemara itself, Svara often overrides the Pasuk. Because human reason is in line, if you like, with the Tzelem Elokim. And therefore, for us, this idea of anti-rationalism, it, to us, is absurd, and we certainly don't go for it. Therefore, the idea of synthesizing is more in our camp, if you like, than the Christian camp. If you look in number 5, Torah Amada denotes the synergistic interrelation of religious studies and secular or profane knowledge. What does synergistic mean? A synergy means each is giving, if you like, kayach to the other. Each is feeding the other and building the other. The more Torah, like in Ein Torah, Ein Derech Eretz, in Ein Derech Eretz, Ein Torah, etc. And he goes on in number 6 to say, Torah, faith, religious learning on the one side, and Mada, science. Now we're going to talk about other areas than science, because we need to think a little bit about literature as well. And at the end, towards the end of the shir, I want to bring you a few pieces by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who has a lot, a very interesting to say about things about literature. If we could only understand what he has to say, we'll be doing well. But we'll see about literature later. Worldly knowledge on the other, together offer us a more overarching and truer vision than either one set alone. Now, in fairness, that's what Rav Hirsch said last week as well. Meaning, if you don't have a vision of Mada, then you don't have a full vision of Torah either, is what he's saying. Rav Hirsch said that last week. You cannot make full judgments on Torah without any knowledge of the other side. Each set gives one view of the Creator as well as his creation, and the other a different perspective that may not agree at all with the first. Each alone is true, but only partially true. Already he's beginning, I think, to push a little. Torah is true, but only partially true. Okay? Meaning, you cannot get to full truth without going beyond Torah. Both together present the possibility of a larger truth, more in keeping with the nature of the subject of our concern. Yet they are given from one shepherd, which is a quote there from Kohelet by Chagiga, God gave everything. God created the world. God made Mada as well. But is that true? Did God make human literature? Did God create the arts and culture and theatre as well? So we'll see how that works. Science is easier in terms of understanding the natural world. Physics, chemistry, biology, you can attribute that more to the idea of God's creation. But the human arts, the social sciences, etc., maybe a little bit less. Have a look at number 7. Torah Amada is just an effort. Not at all unprecedented in the history of normative Judaism. Now, he makes a claim. It's not unprecedented. So fine, let's see where the precedents are. We'll see that in a minute. To expand the area of religious interest to include all of creation, and to bring humanity's cultural creativity and cognitive achievements within the parameters of Torah. Okay, very good. The last quote in the beginning section is from Rabbi Belkin. Rabbi Dr. Samuel Belkin was obviously, before Rabbi Lam, was the Dean of Yeshiva University, and he was inaugurated in 1943, and he says the following in his inaugural address. We prefer, number 8, to look upon science and religion as separate domains, which need not be in serious conflict, and therefore need no reconciliation. If you want a modern restatement of that idea, I recommend strongly you read Rabbi Sachs's book, The Great Partnership. The Great Partnership is a fantastic book that Rabbi Sachs wrote. He writes a book every year, at least more than one book every year, but this one was a particularly good one in my opinion. He brought it out about 5-6 years ago. It's about Torah and science, and it's about a partnership, not a conflict. And he has some really very interesting things to say in that book. Thoroughly recommend it. I recommend it to my students. And they usually come back and say they appreciate the recommendation. Therefore, he said, if we seek the blending of science, his word blending is maybe the same as synthesis, and religion, and the integration of secular knowledge with sacred wisdom, then it is not in the subject matter of these fields, but rather within the personality of the individual that we hope to achieve the synthesis. And that's an important state, important line. We're not trying to kind of somehow make a mishmash of Torah and science and create some blended hashkofa. We're trying to create people who represent both of these things. And that's a point. There was recently a forum on a Friday morning here in the Great Synagogue. Richard Joel was there from YU and various other people there, Rabbi Bednarz and others. And Richard Joel quoted this, I believe, as well. This is an important point. So that's what apparently is trying to be achieved. Let's see where it's coming from. So now we get back into the Rambam. Have a look at number 9. Rabbi Lam gives a number of different potential sources for the idea of Torah Mada. And I want to look at 3 of them with you today. One of them is the Rambam. Says the Rambam at the end of the 4th parak of Yesodi HaTorah. Now, in the first 4 parakim of Yesodi HaTorah, the Rambam, it's very interesting to note, the Shulchan Aruch wrote the practical guide to daily halachic life. He starts, wake up in the morning, get out of bed on time, wash your hands, go to shul, say daven shacharis, etc. The Rambam doesn't write a practical guide to halacha in the Mishnah Torah. He writes an overarching halachic guide to everything that a Jewish person has to think, know, do in all times of history, whether now, whether in the time of the Beis HaMikdash. For the Rambam, it's all one thing. When the Rambam talks about Hilchas Seder, okay, I need to keep drop a few references to Pesach in just to gently prepare people in the run-up. Okay, when the Rambam talks about Hilchas Seder, he talks about the Korban Pesach being in the middle of the table. And then he says, man, if you don't live in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, so you don't have the Korban Pesach in the middle of the table, but for him it's one thing. Therefore the Rambam doesn't start the Mishnah Torah, get up in the morning. He says, no, before you can even get up in the morning, there are Yisodot. You have to understand the philosophical, hashkafic foundations of Judaism. Therefore he starts with Hilchot Yisodi HaTorah. And the first 4 chapters are physics, cosmology, astronomy, etc., and metaphysics, philosophy. He says he deals with all of these. Look at what he says, number 9. In Yanei Arba Prakim Eilu, these 4 chapters I've just outlined, Shebechamesh Mitzvahs Eilu, which are actually 5 mitzvahs in the Torah, which he talks about, Ahavat Hashem, etc. Hein Shechachamim Arushonim Korim Oto, Paradise. This is Paradise. The orchard. The orchard that we have to walk in order to understand life. Kamal She'amru Arba Nichnasu LaParadise. Very famous Gemara. 4 people went into the Paradise. Ben Azai, okay, Ben Zoma, Elisha ben Avuya and Rabbi Akiva. But, of course, the downside of a walk in the paradise is only one of them came out. Rabbi Akiva nichnas v'shalom v'yatza v'shalom. The others either died, went mad, or became apikorsim. So the paradise is a dangerous place to walk. That we know. But, says the Rambam, the walk is what we need to do. Afal pishe gedol Yisrael. Hayu chachamim gedolim. Hayu lo kulam hayu behem koich leidu lehasik kol advarim al buriyah. Even though the greatest of the great came before us, not all of them were prepared to walk in the paradise. The Ani Omer, and I want to add, he says, She'en roi l'tayel b'paradise, you shouldn't be walking in the paradise, Elamisha nitmali kreso lechem u'basar, unless you first filled your belly with meat and bread. What's meat and bread? Lechem abasar, hu leida ha'osav ha'mutter. Learn basic, normative, not just basic, but complex Judaism. All the standard Torah ha'nigla. Ukiyot behem mishara mitzvahs. Learn mitzvahs and halacha and go through shav. Do that first. The apple pishit varim elu dover cotton karu. Even though the korat ha'chachamim, even though the rabbi talked about learning shav, mastering Judaism as the relatively smaller part of the combination. The davar gadol is matzim markava. Davar is matzim markava is philosophy and metaphysics. The davar katan habayis da'avay barava. And the smaller matter is mastering Torah, which he says you have to do first. And then he makes an important comment. Afal pi ken ra'uyin heim lahagdiman. Even though you might think that Torah and mitzvahs are the smaller, and chachma and philosophy and the world out there is the bigger, nevertheless you have to first learn Torah. Shehein miyashvim da'atu shal adam tzechilek. That will get your mind straight. Va'od shehein ha'tova gedolah she'ishpia HaKadosh Baruch Hu liyishuv ha'olam. And that's what God has given us to run the world, olam hazeh, kidel ninchol chayi olam haba, and also to get the next world. And by the way, he drops in at the very end, if you think that learning Torah, before you even get to philosophy, if you think that learning Torah is difficult, it is, but here's some words of encouragement. Esher shiyad am, everybody can know them, hakol, everyone can learn Torah. Katan v'gadol, ish v'isha, ba'al leib racha v'ba'al leib katza. Whether you are an intellectual or you're not, don't give up. Torah is for everybody. By the way, this Rambam, even though this is not our topic for today, is a critical and often omitted Rambam in the subject of women and Torah learning. Because the Rambam that people like to quote is the one in Hilchos Talmud Torah, where he says, Kol hamalamed isha Torah, bito Torah, ki ilu malamda tiflut. If you teach women Torah, they'll just turn it to nonsense, because aim, roiv, nashim, datale, mechuvanos lehitlamed, they can't learn properly, women can't learn properly, therefore don't teach them Torah. That the Rambam puts in Hilchos Talmud Torah. And yet here, the Rambam wants, I think, to stress that that's just a mitziyut. That's just the reality. It's not, if you like, an essentialist description of women's capabilities. It's just the way it is. Women are not educated, and therefore you have to expect that people are going to mess stuff up. But in principle, everybody can master Gemara, Shas. He's talking about Gemara. Abayta, the Habayta, Abayta, Rava, Ish, the Isha alike. Yes. Sarah Shneira definitely expanded the, if you like, the vistas of women's Torah learning. But I'm not sure she would necessarily be in favor of women learning Gemara, but I don't know. It's hard to know. It's hard to put things into the mouths of people who are not here. But that's not what I'm talking about here. Once we get sidetracked on women's issues, we'll never get back. But the Rambam is telling us here that there is such a thing as paradise. Paradise is somewhere that you have to go, if you're able to go there, but only after you've first been through the regular areas of Torah, and that then becomes a question of, well, how long does that take? When should I start dipping my feet into the paradise and peeping into the orchard? Should I learn Torah for 5 years, 10 years, 100 years? Yes, Drash and Sod, but I'm not sure that's even the paradise. The Rambam says the paradise is a PhD, the paradise is metaphysics. And all the chokhmas of the world. When do I go into the paradise? And the Ramah, I brought the first part of this last week, when the Ramah talks about learning non-Jewish subjects, secular learning, for the sake of learning, not pranosa, he says, number 10, Mikol Mokom Mutar Lilmoy Ba'Akrai B'Shar Chokhmas, that we saw last week, you're allowed to learn other things on a, if you like, a casual basis. Bilvad Shelo Yiyu Sifrei Minim. Fine. That we saw last week. V'zehu Nikra Bein HaChachamim Ti'ul the paradise. Says the Ramah in Shulchan Aruch, that's what we call a walk in the paradise, learning other chachmas. And by the way, the Ramah himself was a very advanced philosopher. His students went on to study many other things as well. Okay? The Ein La'adam L'tayel B'paradise, Rak La'achas Shemali Kreisu Basar V'Yayin. Interesting, the lechem has turned to yayin. I quite like that. But Basar V'Yayin, meaning you first have to fill yourself up with other things before you go walking in the paradise. For who later Issa the Heta Vidini Hamitzvah. Fine. That's the paradise according to the Rambam, that's the paradise according to the Ramah. The Vilna Gaon comes in with a pithy, short comment in the Shulchan Aruch in number 11, and he quotes the Ramah and he says, Hu midivre ha Rambam? That comes from the Rambam, this idea of paradise. Avalot ra'u et paradise. They never saw the paradise. Lahu, the Laha Rambam. Neither him nor the Rambam. Meaning he's saying, if this is what you think the paradise is, you've obviously never been for a walk in the paradise. Because for the Vilna Gaon and the mystics, the paradise is not learning metaphysics and philosophy and studying at university to PhD. That's not the paradise. The paradise is Kabbalah. It's Jewish mysticism. It's learning Zohar. It's learning the Ari. It's learning the Chochmas of Torah Sanista. That's the paradise. And that's why this whole attitude towards the paradise being secular learning, if you like, has been sidetracked in the last 300 years. Because pretty much everybody in the Orthodox world for the last 300 years has been coming from the position that whereby the paradise is not what the Rambam said, not what the Shulchan Aruch said, but the paradise is what the Vilna Gaon said, which is Kabbalah and mysticism. Yes?
Does the Rambam have a source for calling this the paradise?
Well, he wants to understand the Gemara there. What was Rabbi Akiva doing? What was he studying? Why did you have to get into the whole question as to what is it that Rabbi Elisha ben Avuya saw that turned him into an apikoros? Was it Jewish mysticism? Or was it Kabbalah? Or was it philosophy, Greek philosophy, etc., that turned his head? And the Rambam, I think, has plenty of sources for saying that what Rabbi Elisha ben Avuya and what Acher and Rabbi Akiva were studying was actually Chochmah Yevamis, was Greek wisdom. And the whole subject of Elisha ben Avuya is fascinating. There was a book written a few years ago by a Driven Leaf, which is a strange book, but about the life of, it's really about the life of the author as much as about the life of Elisha ben Avuya, but it there's a lot to be said about that. Yes. Okay, fine, we'll go on for now. So the Rambam says, go for a walk in the paradise if you're able to. So that's obviously a possible source for Torah Umada. And similarly, number 12, he says in the mitzvah of Avas Hashem, Dava Yadu Oboror, number 12 over on page 3, Avas HaKadosh Baruch Hu Niksheret B'Libah Shel Adam, that Ein Avas HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you can't love Hashem, on the source number 12, in your mind fully, Ad Sheyish Gebo Tamid, unless you really focus on God a lot. Keroi appropriately, V'yad of Kol Mashe Be'olam Chutz Mimem. Leave this world, focus on God. The only way we love Hashem is through the knowledge that we have of Hashem. Therefore, Yidiyat Hashem is central to Avas Hashem. The more you know, the more you love. So how do I do that? Says the Rambam, Lefikach, therefore, Tzarecha Adam liyachid atzmo lahavin lahaskil, b'chochmos utzfunos hamoydim lo et kono. You have to, therefore, spend time learning chochma and tzfuna. And the Rambam is not talking here about learning Gemara. He's talking about learning other chochmas of the world, which bring you to an understanding, hamoydim lo, from the word mada, et kono kifikach sheyesh ba'adam lahavin ulahasik. And he takes us back to the first four chapters of Yesod HaTorah, where the Rambam sets out the Aristotelian universe and cosmology and etc., etc. So, Rabbi Lam definitely feels that the Rambam is a legitimate source for the concepts of Torah Amada. But as I said before, it's not clear that the Rambam will take you into Wordsworth, or take you into theatre, or take you into the modern world of arts. That doesn't seem to be what the Rambam is talking about, and therefore maybe he doesn't take us the whole way. Rav Hirsch we talked about last week, and therefore I'm not going to go into again, but I want to talk a little bit about Rav Kook. Rav Kook is another possible source, and Rav Kook demands an entire, not just an entire shir, but an entire series on the thinking of Rav Kook, which maybe I'm not the best person to deliver here, but it's a fascinating topic. I just want to give you a couple of quotes from Rav Kook which help us to maybe understand how he can be a source for this. Now, Rav Kook himself was a fascinating individual, had a very eclectic background. His mother came from a Hasidic background. She was a Chabad Chassid. In fact, when the third Lubavitcher Rebbe died, she inherited a few relics, if you like, from his clothes, a string from his coat, and a few bits of this and that. And she actually, the Rav Kook's mother actually sewed the thread from the Rebbe's coat into Rav Kook's kippah when he was a little boy, so that he would have the Rebbe's, if you like, coat close to him as he was growing and developing, which is interesting. Rav Kook, of course, became then involved in the world of Lithuanian learning. His father was a product of Volozhin. He went to Volozhin. He learned under the Natsiv. But he also exposed himself significantly to the world of the Maskilim that lived in Eastern Europe at the time, and then opened himself up to the world of philosophy as well. And by the time you end up with the writings of Rav Kook, the Pinkasim and others in the 1910s, 20s, 30s, you have an extremely unusual collection of different ideas together. And one of the key themes, of Rav Kook is Kodesh and Chol. Look at what he says. First, a quote in English, for which I really do apologize. It shouldn't really be in English, but you'll get a Hebrew one in a minute. Says the Rav Kook here the following. The sacred must be established on the foundation of the profane. The Chol is the Chomer for the Kodesh, and the Kodesh is the Tzura for it. And the stronger the Chol, the more significant the Kodesh. Now that is a new idea. We haven't seen that yet. The Chol, the Limudei Chol, that the Chol itself is the only thing that can actually contain the spirituality. The more Chol you have, the more potential you have for Kodesh. And it's not that there's Kodesh for Chol, there's Kodesh and not yet Kodesh. And therefore, for Rav Kook, look at the way Rav Kook speaks at the inauguration of Hebrew University. He was there. There's a beautiful picture, actually, when they founded Hebrew U. It was 1920, something like that. He's standing there, and Herbert Samuel's there, and Weizmann's there. I think Albert Einstein is sitting in there somewhere. It's all the great faces of the first half of the 20th century. And Rav Kook spoke at length, actually at great length. That was one of the complaints that people had at the inauguration. But he spoke at length about that, and you can read his drosha there. It's unbelievable. Whether you feel 90 years later that Hebrew U has lived up to his expectations, that's another question you can think about. But he definitely sees this as one of the most fundamental achievements in the growth of Kedusha, that there is a university in Israel that will be, if you like, the chol in order to contain the Kodesh going forward. He says a lot about that there. Have a look at number 14. Rav Kook goes on to say, Yesh olam shel chol. The olam shel Kodesh. There are two apparent worlds. Olamim shel chol. The olamim shel Kodesh. Ha'olamim sotrim ze et ze. These worlds clash. Chol and Kodesh. Are we required to be mavdil? Ha'mavdil ben Kodesh l'chol. They clash with each other. Kemuvan, he says, but it goes without saying, ha'stira hi subjektivit. The stira is only in the eyes of the beholder. It's your understanding of the stira, of the conflict. Ha'adam, a person. Bahasagato, with his understanding, Hamutsum Tsemet, which is by definition limited, Eino Yachol of Asher Bein HaKodesh Uben Achol. He can't bridge that gap. He can't bridge the gap between Kodesh and Chol. A person can't normally do that. The Eino Yachol HaShvot Et Stirotehem. He can't resolve the conflicts. However, Hein Amno Miyushavot Berum Olam. But in a higher level, on a higher plane, Kodesh and Chol are not in conflict. Where is that higher plane? The Machon Kodesh HaKadoshim. The Rav Kook's understanding is, if you imagine a triangle, where you have Kodesh and Chol at the base of the triangle, and the synthesis of the Kodesh and the Chol is what Rav Kook calls Kodesh HaKadoshim. Which is very fascinating, and a lot needs to be said about that. And Rabbi Lam picks that up, and he says as follows, number 15. Yes. The Kodesh Kadoshim means the ability to synthesize, to combine Kodesh and Chol in a way where you have a real Surah and a real Chomer, the two go together. Rav Kook has a lot to say, for example, even about Kira, even about heresy, which abounded, if you like, at the beginning of the 20th century, which is looking at the secular Zionist movement, which was anti-religious in many ways at the beginning of the 20th century. Rav Kook says, no. They are what they say they are, but that's actually only giving us the opportunity to think more deeply about the things that we believe, and that heresy, if you like, will raise us to a higher level, and them as well, eventually, to what's called Kodesh Kodoshim. That's one of the reasons why Rav Kook was under such attack, that he came out with statements that equate Kodesh and Chol. The famous statement in Orot that he got into so much trouble for, where he talks about the physical exercises of the kibbutznikim. Imagine in the 1920s world of creating the new Jew, the strong, muscly Jew of the eugenic era, okay? Rav Kook says there in Orot that the physical exercises, the workouts of the kibbutznikim are to be compared with Tehillim and Torah of the Yeshiva Bochrim, when they're learning. Both of them are building, if you like, the people of Israel. And boy, did he get into trouble for that one. And they say that Rav Tzvi Yehuda, his son, who edited Orot, begged him not to include that in the Orot, because he could see what it was going to lead to, and indeed it led exactly to what he thought it was going to lead to. But Rav Kook said, no, I will not take it back. I will keep it there. So obviously that's a decontextualized just snippet from Rav Kook. It's not fair to say that's representative of everything. But have a look at what Rav Lam says. Number 15. Rav Hirsch's view of Torah and wisdom is one of coexistence and is therefore essentially static. Rav Kook's is of interaction and is hence dynamic. Rav Hirsch is an aesthete who wants Torah and Derech Eretz to live in a neighborly and non-combative fashion for the cultural enhancement of both. I like that. Rav Kook is an alchemist who wants the sacred to transmute the profane and recast it in its own image. Hence, for Rav Kook, Torah Amada represents a genuine synthesis with all the benefits and problems and dangers, we'll talk about danger in a minute, associated with that. For Rav Hirsch, for whom secular studies are employed to order, define and assist the sacred and place it on a firm scientific basis, Torah and Derech Eretz is a relationship of coexistence. For Rav Kook, the motion goes in both directions. The less important one is the rationalization, explanation, dormance of the sacred by the profane. The far more significant is the radiation of Kodesh towards the whole, ennobling it, raising it to the loftiest levels, sanctifying it, impregnating it with meaning and purpose. And Rav Hirsch actually, Rav Lam, by the way, actually goes on to talk about Torah Amada almost as a chassidut. The relationship between Rav Kook and Chassidut is fascinating, but not for now. But Rav Lam talks about the idea of Chassidus. What is Chassidus? Gathering sparks of holiness in the world and being able to do Avodah Hashem, Avodah Begashmias. Meaning, I don't need to sit and be a world-class Talmud Chacham to be an Eved Hashem. Chassidut will say, I can also be a, you know, to the parody case, it's Heavy the Milkman. You know, I can also milk the cow in a way which is connecting me to Avodas Hashem, and if I can find Kedusha in milking the cow, says Rav Lam, I can find Kedusha in a PhD as well. And therefore he talks about it at the top of page 4, I'm not going to read this source in detail, you can look at it yourself, because I need to go on, I don't want to lose the time, but he talks about the idea of Avodas Hashem through corporeality, and therefore Avodas Hashem through intellectuality. And then he comes out with a great one-liner in number 18, which got Rabbi Lam into trouble, which is, the study of the sciences and humanities is, in effect, the study of Gemara. And thus, the fulfillment of the study of Torah. I'll read that line again. 18. The study of sciences and humanities is, in effect, the study of Gemara. And thus the fulfillment of the study of Torah. Now, that is quite a line. And the question is that really realistic? I mean, when you look at the world of Torah Omada, and you go to Stern College and YU and all of the SciSims and all the programs that are part of that, is indeed the study of sciences and humanities the study of Gemara, or is it not? And there are many within Yeshiva University who take extreme exception to this and don't agree with it at all. At the very end, I'm going to show you some other voices from YU as to what they think Torah Omada is. But I want you to understand, at least from Rabbi Lam, that is something that he feels very strongly about. There are a few health warnings, and I want to give you these as we finish with Rabbi Lam, because he's not naive. He's not oblivious to the problems that this causes. Have a look here at a few sources from 19 onwards. When we speak of Torah Omada, it is not because of practical economic necessity, or because we impute any imperfection or inadequacy to Torah, but because we affirm that both Torah and nature are the results of divine revelation. Even as God is one, there is no split between his self-revelation in Torah and his self-disclosure in nature. So we're not downgrading Torah, he says. 20, it should be made clear that when we propose the Hasidic or Mada as worship model, like I said, Neo-Chassidut, of Torah Mada, based on this tenet of Avodah B'Gashmias, we rule out any equality between Avodah B'Gashmias and a formal mitzvah, between Torah and Mada. They're not the same thing. Meaning, maybe he thinks that studying one is like studying the other, but they're not the same thing. The pursuit of Mada without Torah is devoid of any innate Jewish significance. Hence, in addition to requiring that Mada be pursued for L'shem Shamayim, so he wants people to be in Yeshiva University studying their PhD L'shem Shamayim, and in the spirit of awe and reverence recommended by Talmud for Talmud Torah, he wants them to be Yiras Shamayim, the religious legitimacy of Mada would require that one spends a significant proportion of his time in the formal study of Torah. You can't just go to university, he said. That's not what I'm saying. You have to learn Torah, you have to become a Talmud Chacham, and you have to also somehow combine, synthesize that with your Mada. 21, to vulgarize the concept as an excuse to minimize the study of Torah, or to deny centrality either theoretically or functionally, is to distort it most deplorably. He says, don't take me out of context. Skip 22 for a second. Look at 24. The primacy of Torah must be a given in any via Torah Amada approach. This precludes any version of Torah Amada that treats Torah as a form of human culture only. So he says, I'm not trying to downgrade Torah. You have to be a Torah person. You have to be a Talmud Chacham. You can't just use Torah Amada as an excuse to say that you're a Torah person, but at the same time, just ignore it and do a degree or learn Mada, whereas actually Torah is not important for you at all. And we have to ask ourselves, how does all of this translate into the mind of a 16-year-old, or an 18-year-old, or even a 20-year-old? How do they do this? Rabbi Lam is quite demanding. You have to be L'shem Shamayim, you have to be full of Avas Hashem, Avoda in your mind, and Yiras Shamayim. There's a lot of stuff that goes into doing your sociology degree here. It's not just a question of going to university. And he's well aware of the dangers. Therefore, I want to just finish with Rabbi Lam on page 5 and read you something beautiful from Rav Soloveitchik himself, which of course is where Rav Lam gets it from. Have a look at page 20, number 25. As attractive and spiritually edifying as this doctrine of worship through corporeality is, it is quite dangerous too. It is replete with antinomian possibilities. What does he mean by antinomian possibilities? People will stop keeping halacha. People cannot be expected to be exposed and immersed in a world of secular life and still feel that halacha is important to them. It's a danger. Taken too far, it can undermine the halacha. And number 26, whenever there is an encounter of the sacred and profane, there must be anxiety. For who knows? But instead of the Kodesh converting the Chol might master the Kodesh. He who enters into this dialogue of Torah and wisdom must tremble at the risks inherent in it, even while acknowledging that it is his duty to undertake it. Many religious casualties have already resulted from this historic program of Torah and Mada, and there are more yet to come. That's an interesting statement. Rabbi Lam. Meaning, he believes in this with his whole heart. But, he knows that people will fall by the wayside. And that's an interesting question. Does a hashkafa, if you like, lose any legitimacy because it's risky? Or actually, do you have to play a high risk, high gain game in life? Do we take low risks for low gain, or do we take higher risks for what we perceive as higher gain? And I want you to see this piece from Rav Soloveitchik at number 30, which I think will help us to at least address that question a little bit. You can read the rest of Rabbi Lam when you get the chance in English. Have a look at number 30 at the bottom. I'm sorry, the print's a little bit small, but if you think this is small, wait till you see the next page. Okay. Says Rav Soloveitchik in Ha'adam Ve'olamo, number 30. Thirty at the bottom of the page. Ala pasuk, on the pasuk, Vayehi ish echad min haramatayim. Who are we talking about? Actually, his father, Elkanah. Okay, remember haramatayim tzofim mihar Ephraim ushmo Elkanah. What about Elkanah? He lived min haramatayim. He lived on two peaks. Omrim Chazal, Adam haba mishtei ramot. He was a person that came from two peaks. Shitzofot zo et zo, that each look out to the other. Elkanah, says Rav Soloveitchik, Hayehudi hakasher, she'atid haya lihiyot aviv shel Shmuel hanavi. He was going to become the father of Shmuel. Dar haya al shtei ramot, he lived on two peaks, shebeinehem pura tahom, in between which there was a chasm, a vast gap. Bein shtei ramot, Yesh livnot gesher. If you live on a world of two peaks with a chasm in between, you must build a bridge, says Rav Soloveitchik. You must livnot gesher. Second, im rotzim likasher. If you want to, or likshoy, if you want to tie beinehem between them, bli lipol chalila letoch hatahol. If you don't want to fall in the gap, you have to build a bridge. Anu ayuhudim oskim. We Jews, we're busy. Niyamav shel Elkanah, from the days of Elkanah onwards, the bniyat hagesher hazeh. We're trying to build this bridge. Lo gamarnu adayin et hamalacha hazeh, hazo, va'anu yodim, and we know, we haven't finished yet. Ki lo alecha ligmor. We don't have to complete the work. Kasher mumushechet hi mumalechet hakisho. It's really difficult. Building this bridge is very tough. V'hari hi hamatara shela, this, the purpose of this, anu makatshim et kol ma'atzmein. We are dedicating our life to building this bridge. Ein anu rotzim lehitztamtzem b'rama achad. We're not prepared, says Rav Soloveitchik, to restrict ourselves to one peak only. She'ifateinu hi shetehavei izun. These are good words. We want there to be a balance, the chibur and a connection, nachon, an appropriate balance of connection, bein olam hakodesh hayaguti or bein olam hamada. Hadat shall klal ha'anushut. We want to build a bridge between our world of Torah and the world of humanity, the world of human knowledge. Zeu tafkid kasher b'yoter. It's really difficult. Rabim hachalalim shenaflu b'zeh. And that's where Rabbi Lam is echoing this. Many have fallen on the wayside. And there are many people in the world who feel it's prohibited. We're not allowed to build this bridge. You can't live in two worlds, they say. You can't be in this world and in that world. You can't jump, you can't skip from one peak to the next. And if you try to do that, you'll just fall into the chasm. And we find this even from Gedolei Olam. Over on the next column, I understand these people who are worried. Hacharidim, who are scared. I don't know if he means Charidim or Charidim. Okay? But Hasovrim, and who feel, ki yesh ladur al rama achat. You can only live in one world till that. Because of the inherent danger in it. I understand them. I'm also scared, he says. I'm not relaxed. I'm anxious. I know what pressure we're putting our children under, our families under. I know how difficult this is. Bonatena and our daughters. In telling that they have to find a way to bridge these two worlds. I know that the pressure that they're under. But we are astounded and impressed, he says, many times at how our youth cope with this. Hadar b'shtei ramot, who live on these two worlds. V'hu tarud yom v'layla b'melechet ha'kodesh hazot. Now, he did that himself.
That's why, and he, Yahu Ababa to Rebbe, Yahu Rabbi thought the Ram is the only way to this. They were able to bridge it.
The question is then, how does your average college kid in NYU, Rutgers, Maryland, wherever they are, how do they do this without falling into the Tahom? So is this Shita of Torah Amada only for the elite? Only for the Rav Soloveitchiks and those like him?
It's for the ones who keep learning Torah, not just the 12
days. So what are they? So their world is meant to be which world then? If they're not going to do this, what are they meant to do?
Depends on the family,
Well, that's it. Can you really ask people to do this on an ongoing basis? That's the question. Most people, the average person. Yes. Right.
Finish grad school or college or whatever, and then you go to work. But in the Jewish tradition of society, it wasn't like that.
Correct.
Learning was all your life.
Correct.
It's not necessarily talking about a 16-year-old.
But a 16-year-old in America, as we all know, the purpose of high school is to prepare kids for college. That's the way that high school works. And therefore, if you're in a Jewish yeshiva day school, which espouses the principle of Torah Amada, the question is, how do you actually make this work in practice with this group, with this demographic? That's the question that has to be asked. It's very difficult. The question is, given that it's very difficult, is therefore the answer that we should basically accept that it's difficult, accept that it won't work, and therefore do something else instead? And that something else will be what? Will be not to go to university. Will be just to go to Yeshiva Gedola, and if you need to get a job, so then you'll have to go to college to is a vocational training. Meaning, why are you trying to get your kids to Harvard? Put them into some college so they'll learn to be a this or a that, and they'll learn a paranoia. This is a very pressing question. And the modern Orthodox world in America is actually not, I don't think, grappling with this question in practice, but is suffering from this question. This is a question, and I have no answers as to how to go forward, but to understand Rav Soloveitchik, I think, is critical. I don't want to run out of time. I want to just tell you what page 6 is without reading it. Page 6 is another vision of Torah Umada from someone that you may have come across, Rabbi David Schatz, who is an important contributor to, there's a journal called the Torah Umada Journal, which is produced by YU, which is fascinating articles, fascinating essays. And he has a slightly different approach there. I've just brought you the conclusion. I'm not going to read it. The print's too small, and we don't have enough time. But he there suggests a more practical approach to Torah Amada. don't necessarily make it into some overarching beautiful philosophy, but it's more approach to how to work in the world of 21st century technology, meaning he says there's a hypocrisy in the world that takes advantage of the technology and lives in the modern world, but pretends that it doesn't live in the modern world. And belittles and derides academia and mocks academia, and then is quite prepared to go for an operation using the top surgeon, using the very academia that it has derided and mocked in its Hashkafas HaChaim. And he says, that's not correct. You can't do that. And therefore he wants to suggest that Torah Amada is not necessarily a philosophy of chinuch only, but it's also a way that you live in a non-hypocritical way in the world around you, embracing the technology, and not trying to, if you like, secularize it. And this is an important point. He says one of the outcomes of the hypocrisy of Kli, he's pointing at the non-modern Orthodox, the more Haredi world, he says that quite a part of the hypocrisy he's pointing to is that it actually causes the non-Torah world to be totally secular. Whereas in fact there are opportunities to make that world much more Kodesh, and they're being ignored. And therefore I think you should read not just his conclusion here, but also his entire work. But I need to go to Rav Lichtenstein, because I promised myself that I wouldn't run out of time, and I don't want to run out of time. We started a few minutes late, but I'm going to try and finish for you on time as well. Have a look at Rav Lichtenstein, because Rav Lichtenstein on page 7, he, if you like, represents the world of Torah Amada in the world of the arts of humanities of literature. Because he himself, I'm sure many of you knew Rav Lichtenstein far better than I did. I only knew him as an older person, not in his youth and his prime. But he, of course, was extremely advanced in his understanding of literature. He had a PhD in English literature from Harvard, and that didn't take away at all from his hatmada in learning Torah. And I want to just show you a few pieces from Rav Lichtenstein here. Some of these are taken from a very interesting article by Jeffrey Sachs, which I've referred to at the bottom, but I'll share with you a few ideas. Number 31. These are all from Rav Lichtenstein. Among those who have at least attained and revealed some measure of knowledge, great writers are preeminent. We can't ignore great writers in the non-Jewish world. In reading them, we can confront the human spirit doubly, as creation and as creator. We create these writings. As regards enriching our understanding of Ruach Mamalala. Who is Ruach Mamalala? Who is described as a Ruach Mamalala?
Ledaber.
What is it? Adam HaRishon, when he's created, Targum Onkelos describes Adam HaRishon as a Ruach Mamalala, a communicative being, okay, a speaking being. Says Rav Lichtenstein that literature is the epitome of Ruach Mamalala. Imaginative artists have been more illuminating than theoreticians. Not only because they've described more powerfully, but because they've also probed more deeply. You can get deeper by literature than you can, he says, by philosophy. The artist melds precision and sensitivity, intuition and acuity to perceive and portray concrete personal and social realities. He's real. Philosophy is not always real in most people's lives. But art is, and literature is. It talks about real things and real people. 33, in Hamlet, you can witness the greatness of man on one hand, and on the other to see the greatest of Western writers, Shakespeare, as a living expression of what mankind can achieve, to the height that Ruach Mamalala can ascend. 34, our moral and religious lights did not address themselves with equal vigor to every area of spiritual endeavor. Meaning, from Torah alone, you won't get a full human picture of the human condition. Chazal engaged little in systematic theology or philosophy, and the legacy includes no poetic corpus. It's interesting. Although Piyutim, later, there is poetry, but from Chazal not. An account of Rabbi Akiva's spiritual odyssey could no doubt eclipse Augustine's. Don't get me wrong, he says. I don't think that Augustine is higher chas v'shalom than Rabbi Akiva. But his confessions have been discreetly muted. The rigors of John Stuart Mill's education are not without parallel in our history, but what corresponds to his fascinating autobiography? Or the passionate apologia pro vita sua of his contemporary John Henry Cardinal Newman? I don't pretend to be a great Renaissance man myself, although I do know that Cardinal Newman was a famous convert from Protestantism to Roman Catholic the church in the 19th century in England, and he talks a lot about this. Our Johnsons have no Boswells. Samuel Johnson's autobiography was written by Boswell, so that's how we know about him. Where in our treasure shall we encounter a despondent and tragically deserted father to compare with King Lear? Or thousands who have been imprisoned, who have been imprisoned, who has left a record of his experience on a par with Boethius's De Consolatione Philosophiae or Bonhoeffer's Letters from Prison? Okay? Bonhoeffer was imprisoned by the Nazis and executed by the Nazis for his opposition to their regime. Do we have a period of inspired passion to wedded love to match Spencer's epithalamium? Sorry, I should be more educated. Epithalamium. How do you pronounce that?
Epithalamium.
All right, fine. Epithalamium. Do we have one? I even read the poem this morning, or read part of it, over my breakfast. And it's really interesting. It's very nice. It's an ode to his wife on the wedding day. Do we have something like that? And if not, why don't we use that to enhance our understanding of the human condition? While frequently declaring that literature and humanities are not the only exclusive path to attain the types of sense... Actually, let's skip this one. Because I want to finish with 36 and 37. Rav Lichtenstein states, this is Rabbi Sachs talking, that his own reading, 36, has reinforced an awareness of the spiritual significance of the best that has been thought and said in the world. For what is it that culture offers us? This is now, he's going to quote Rav Lichtenstein. In relation to art, profound expressions of the creative spirit, an awareness of structure and its interaction with substance and consequently the ability to organize and present ideas. In relation to life, the ability to understand, appreciate, and confront our personal, communal, and cosmic context, sensitivity to human condition, and some assistance in coping with it. In relation to both, a literary consciousness which enables us to transcend our own milieu and place it in a broader perspective. Above all, a culture instills in us a sense of the moral, psychological, and metaphysical complexity of the human life. And he finishes by saying in number 37, I'll finish with this, says Rav Lichtenstein, my general education has contributed much to my personal development. I know my understanding of Tanakh would be far shallower in every respect without it. I know that it has greatly enhanced my perception of life in Eretz Israel. I know that it has enriched my religious experiences. I know that when my father was stricken blind, Milton's profoundly religious sonnet on his blindness and its magnificent conclusion, they also serve who only stand and wait, stood me in excellent stead. A very beautiful writing in and of itself, a work of literature. Okay, but I think Rav Lichtenstein was also well aware of the challenges of this, and yet he believed in it very strongly, and he didn't turn around and encourage his students not to go to university with all of the dangers that entails. But nevertheless, this is a very difficult cheshbon. This is a difficult concern, and I have no answers to give you in terms of how to get that right, other than to think about it more, I think, which is important. I brought you at the end some other voices from YU which may differ very strongly from what we've said. Some people's view of Torah Amada is it's basically a yeshiva with a cafeteria. That's what YU is, you know. But that's, I think, extreme on the other side, okay? But I think there are other voices in between, and I've tried to present some of them. So if nothing else, we've seen some of the multifaceted sources on this topic, and I wish to bring to a close. Next week, as they say, for something completely different, I would like to talk about the halakhic and hashkafic challenges of cosmetic surgery. So, please God, next week we will talk about that.